From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with economist John Kenneth Galbraith. Since the 1930s, Galbraith has alternately shaped and critiqued American fiscal policy. Also today, I talk with veteran TV actress Betty White. She now stars as Rose on the NBC series The Golden Girls. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Shades, the new album from pianist Andrew Hill, and television critic David Bianculli reviews Star Trek, The Next Generation, the new series that picks up where Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock left off. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is John Kenneth Galbraith, who for decades has been one of America's most influential liberal economists. Journalist David Halberstam once described Galbraith as an enormous figure who tends to dominate every group, every scene, with a combination of size, intellect, humor, and sheer gall. During his career, Galbraith worked in the Roosevelt administration, served as an advisor and speechwriter for Adlai Stevenson's presidential campaign, and was ambassador to India under Kennedy. His economic theories helped inspire Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program, and he was one of the first Democrats to publicly oppose the war in Vietnam. Throughout his political career, he remained a professor of economics at Harvard University, where he is now professor emeritus. Galbraith's books have reached popular audiences, generations of students, as well as political insiders. His books include American Capitalism, The Affluent Society, and The New Industrial State. A new book on economic history titled Economics in Perspective has just been published by Houghton Mifflin. John Kenneth Galbraith will celebrate his 79th birthday next week. He came of age during the Depression, and he told me how those years impressed upon him the need for and the importance of good economic planning.
I was studying agriculture in Ontario in Canada. In fact, I've often said that I'm the only senior member of the Harvard faculty with a first degree in animal husbandry. And I reached the conclusion in those years that we could produce better and better farm products, higher and higher quality. But the real problem was whether they would sell or not, whether you could make a living producing them. So I shifted my attention on those grounds to economics. And it was a considerable decision. I've been involved with it ever since.
But I guess with the Depression, you could see economics as a life and death issue as opposed to as an academic discipline.
Yeah, that was true. And it was also quite wonderful. The autumn of 1934, I just finished taking my degree at Berkeley and was on the way to Harvard, which had just hired me, and I stopped for a few weeks, 3 or 4 months in Washington. Well, I stopped to see some of my old professors. And such wonderfully was the shortage of economists that I was put on the payroll the next day. And that was my first experience of government. I was put on the payroll, and in spite of the fact that I was a Canadian citizen and nobody asked me my citizenship, I did have to go to the top floor of the South Building of the Department of Agriculture and affirm that I was a Democrat. I had no difficulty doing that. And so that there was two sides. The Depression, and particularly the New Deal, created a strong market for members of my profession.
Well, from 1941 to 43, you became known as the economic czar in the Roosevelt administration. You were the deputy administrator of the Office of Price Controls. This was really one of your first chances to actually put your economic theory into practice. Did your theories work in practice during those years?
Well, I had some experiences before that. I'd made a major study of the whole public works program, which was published on approximately the same day as the fall of France, and sank into an obscurity from which it's never been rescued. But I was put in charge of organizing the price control system of the country in the spring of 1941. I discovered after I'd been in that job for a few months that the basic idea with which I'd come in, which was a kind of selective price control, would not work. and that one had to have a blanket overall control of prices. And I changed my mind with a minimum of difficulty.
That's interesting that you'd say that, because I would think it would be very difficult to change your own theory or to change your mind. People are always looking over your shoulder.
No, people weren't, as a matter of fact, and others were seeing the same problem as I did. And I discovered on that one occasion that I had a certain measure of mental flexibility, at least when that was the practical thing to do. But I held that job until 1943, by which time my enemies had far outnumbered my friends. And I must say that in terms of power, authority, responsibility, my life has been downhill ever since.
Do you mean that seriously?
Nothing. Oh, sure. I've never had anything like the responsibilities I carried at that time. Nothing.
You say that your enemies outnumbered your friends. What made you so unpopular?
I think possibly there was a natural juvenile lack of tact. As I look back on it, I think I would be much more tactful now. I was only in my early 30s. But the much more serious problem was that everybody's price I fixed or we fixed, and every request for an increase that we denied made somebody or other bitterly anti-Galbraith. I think you can understand that, can't you?
Oh, sure.
If I fixed your, you know, really incredible salary as a public broadcaster, how would you feel about me?
Oh, sure. I mean, certainly my opinion of you would be based on what salary you decided I should be getting. Absolutely. So people all across the country had strong opinions on the prices that you were setting.
Unquestionably. In those days, I got up every morning and looked at my calendar to see what congressional committee was investigating my abuse of power that day. You'd be surprised how many committees there were. Indeed, I was talking about this earlier today. I once calculated that as a result of that experience, and a considerable amount since, that I have in my life spent just under a year before congressional committees, somewhere in the neighborhood of 300. How is that for wasted time?
Well, you know, I think it was also during the period when you were the deputy administrator in the Office of Price Control that the FBI started.
Office of Price Administration.
I'm sorry.
See how much nicer that sounds.
Sounds much more neutral, doesn't it? Isn't that when the FBI started their dossier on you?
Well, I once wrote a piece for Esquire called My 40 Years with the FBI, which goes rather beyond the dossiers that in that quite marvelous piece of Herbert Mitgang's in the current New Yorker. I suppose it did. My impression, however, was that I became of more interest to the FBI in various subsequent posts or various subsequent activities. But I suppose actually there was an FBI investigation even at that early stage.
Well, while we're on the subject, what most surprised you when you got your Freedom of Information Act file?
What most surprised me, well, there were three things. One was the cultural problem. FBI agents were struggling with issues which they really didn't understand. For example, you could figure out who was giving information by knowing who was the plausible person and counting the number of letters, even though the names were blacked out. And the FBI went to an old professorial colleague of mine at Princeton, who, a very conservative man, wanted to repeal the 20th century, and asked him about me, and he said, well, Galbraith, he's very doctrinaire. But the poor FBI man heard that as Dr. Ware. And for the next 10 years, whenever I was up for some public post, there was some investigation, The file would say he's under the influence of one Dr. Ware, otherwise unidentified. Then, but the second thing was more surprising. And that, not surprising, really. It is what your friends would say about you. All of them, almost without exception, would say exactly what they thought would be most useful to you. Oh, Galbraith is very conservative. Galbraith is quite reactionary. An old professor at Harvard who was asked about me said, well, he's a little bit to the left, but nothing like Franklin D. Roosevelt. And so everybody would come quite bravely to your support and say things about you that you wouldn't like to hear in public about how, as I say, how conservative you were. And thirdly, am I going too far on this?
No, it's interesting.
Thirdly, there were times when it wasn't particularly flattering. Sometime in the 1950s, I gave some testimony before the House Senate Banking Currency Committee, and the market took a terrific drop while I was testifying. And somebody, a senator from Indiana, said this was the action of a typical subversive, breaking the market this way. First time that it was ever considered subversive to bring about a stock market decline, I suppose. And then, in desperation, he went to through an intermediary to J. Edgar Hoover to get some support for this proposition. And there was a great investigation. This is all in the file. Minute by minute, day by hour by hour, who they talked to. And finally they came up with a conclusion, which must have been terribly disturbing to Senator Capehart. It said, our investigation shows that Professor Galbraith is arrogant, somewhat conceited, but not disloyal. In any other community, that would have been considered very disagreeable, but at that moment, it was a great exoneration.
Right. My guest is John Kenneth Galbraith, who, by the way, has written a new book titled Economics in Perspective. You were one of John F. Kennedy's earliest supporters, and you've described him as one of the few public men wholly satisfied with his personality. Would you explain what you meant by that?
Well, I remember going down to see him the week after the nomination, after we got back from Los Angeles in 1960. I went down with Arthur Schlesinger for a Sunday lunch. And marvelous comment. He said, the campaign is not going to be tiring for me because I can be myself. It's going to be quite tiring for Richard Nixon because he has a problem of his identity. But I don't have to think about that. And I think this was an extremely important characteristic of the president, that he was never plagiarizing himself. One of the extraordinary things about politics, and in some ways one of the depressing things about politics, is that political candidates, people in public life, began sooner or later, many of them, to imitate their own public image, their own television image, or what they're, how they're described in the papers, in the press. As I say, they plagiarize themselves. This is something that Kennedy never did. One consequence was that there was a certain candor, a certain marvelous candor in his speech, which was just extraordinarily refreshing.
He made you ambassador to India. Why didn't he keep you around as an economic advisor?
I think on the whole, he preferred to have me in India. I'm quite tall, as you know. I have no particular talent for anonymity, and people around the White House are meant to keep out of sight. And I think that Kennedy had grave doubts as to whether I could be there in secret. The other thing was that I had just that spring published, no, it was the spring before, my dates were wrong. I just published a year before The Affluent Society, which had got a great deal of attention, I'm happy to say, and which could have, if my appearance in Washington, could have committed the president to ideas which were perhaps a bit ahead of their time, or maybe wrong, for that matter.
Yeah, so you might have been a little too controversial to keep around.
I was a little too controversial. I don't like to say they were wrong. Let me just say they were ahead of their time.
My guest is economist, best-selling author, and Harvard professor John Kenneth Galbraith. His new book is titled Economics in Perspective, and it's just been published by Houghton Mifflin. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Economist John Kenneth Galbraith is my guest. You were one of the first liberal Democrats to publicly oppose the war in Vietnam. Did you try to work behind the scenes before going public about your opposition?
Oh, sure. Kennedy sent me out to Saigon in the autumn of 1961, knowing that I had some doubts about the war, and hoping, I think really hoping, that he would get the kind of report that he thought I might make. And I, it was a very short trip, and I suppose maybe I had my mind partly made up in advance. I knew that part of the world somewhat better than some of the people in Washington. And I concluded then that it was a hopeless exercise, that we were being regarded not as defenders of democracy, but as another interventionist force, as the French had been, as the Japanese had been, and as for many centuries the Chinese had been, and that we were in association with a government that was not considered tolerable by its own people, which had the strong opposition of the whole Buddhist community. And so I came back, and for the next several years, In association with Kennedy and with Lyndon Johnson, a man whom I greatly admired, I argued against the intervention there, made various proposals as to how we might negotiate or get out, and then I eventually decided that my desire to be in, my desire to have a close association with Washington, was getting the better of my better judgment, so I went public, started making speeches against the war, joined up with Gene McCarthy.
What were some of the difficulties of publicly opposing friends and colleagues, which is what you had to do?
I felt very badly about it. I think I can say that Lyndon Johnson and I were at one time very good friends. We're the same age. We both came into Washington, into that milieu from rural backgrounds. And he rightly, you can understandably, expected his friends in a difficult time to come to his support. And I didn't. And that hurt me, and it, I think, well, there was no doubt that it hurt him, too. He didn't like it a bit. So I found it a very disagreeable thing. And also, I had a lot of other friends who were identified with the war, had become involved in a kind of incrementalism. That's a rather formidable word, but let me explain. It's very important. They... easy course, the tempting course, is always to say just a little more, not to change course, not to pull out, but to say, if we just do this, if we just do this, if we do just a little more of this, a few more troops and so forth, then we're we think we're on the way out. Whereas the person who says, look, for goodness sakes, let's call a halt, sounds rather irresponsible. He's drastic. So that the whole temptation is to stay on course. And incidentally, that very phrase, stay on course, sounds rather good, doesn't it?
Right, I know what you mean by the incrementalism, because a little bit and a little bit adds up to a lot over time.
That is right.
Did you feel that having a home base at Harvard University helped you to be intellectually honest because you didn't have to depend on Washington for a livelihood or for a vehicle to express your opinions?
Well, one should always be extremely suspicious of anybody who praises his own intellectual honesty. I have made compromises. I've always also, particularly as ambassador, became expert in the art of self-censorship. You kind of run a computer program through your mind as to what the Congress will say, what the President will say, what the State Department will say, what the government to which you're accredited will say, and the consequence is that you have a censorship which is marvelously designed to keep you from saying anything interesting at all. But on your main point, there's absolutely no question. The ideal situation in Washington is to be able to take the next plane out of town.
Right.
Whatever your inner courage, the knowledge that you can do that enormously reinforces it.
John Kenneth Galbraith is my guest, and by the way, he's written a new book titled Economics in Perspective. You once wrote that one of the perils of our age is that the gravest decisions must be made by tired people, and you were referring to presidents and the presidential staff. How did you see that problem manifest itself?
Oh, very often, one would get a decision. This was certainly true in the State Department, where I had two tours of duty, from meetings where everybody had reached the point where any decision was better than just continuing the discussion, and where the fatigue had been the circumstance that forced the result. And that was what I had in mind there, and I think this is true in business. I think it's true of faculty meetings. I think very often the decision is taken not because people think it is right, but because the participants are so tired that they can't go on.
We know, in keeping on the subject of fatigue, you also wrote that when you worked for Kennedy, that you both used prescription sleeping pills because it was so difficult to unwind and fall asleep after the tensions of the day. Did that have consequences? Did it leave you tired the next day or a little dull from having...
Oh, unquestionably. There was, in moments of great tension. I mean, I don't want to be wrong here, or give the wrong impression. Somebody described being an ambassador like being the pilot of an airplane. Hours of boredom and moments of panic. And so there were many, many hours, many days when as ambassador I was under no strain whatever. I did a certain amount of writing in those days. But then, as in the autumn of 1962, when India and China fell out in that border war over some territory in the Himalayas that you could only hope would belong to somebody else, the whole burden of that responsibility fell on me because it also coincided with the missile crisis in the Caribbean. And this poses the problem. Either you stay awake and are tired the next day, or you take a sleeping pill and you're slightly fuzzy the next day. And what is worse, about an hour after you've taken the damn pill, the telephone rings or somebody comes in and you have to get up and handle some business.
Which you're not prepared to do because you're under the influence of the sleeping pill.
And you're possibly a menace to public order and stability because you're still half asleep.
Has this been one of the hidden problems of politics, do you think?
I don't know. Since I wrote about it in that journal that I kept in India, it hasn't been exactly a secret in my life.
I'd like to quote something that this is from the opening paragraph of your book, The Affluent Society. You wrote, "Until a rich man learns to live with his wealth, he will have a well-observed tendency to put it to the wrong purposes or otherwise to make himself foolish." I'd imagine that you really got a lot of money from the bestsellers that you had, and I wonder if you ever feared that you'd be using money that you accumulated for the wrong purposes.
Well, there wasn't all that much. I'm not saying that I've ever lived in stark, grim poverty, but you'd be surprised at how many books you can write and how much and how little you have after, among the other things, after taxes. I've never resorted to tax shelters and that sort of thing. But I've never had such a feeling. I've tried to be rather supportive of a certain number of causes, but I've never had any sense of guilt over the support that I accorded my wife, my sons, or in some cases my friends.
You grew up on a farm, and the way you've told it in your autobiography, you were thrilled to get out, and you really didn't take to the farm chores very well. You've been through difficult times because of the great decisions that you've had to make, and because of all the tension associated with having to make really important decisions. When things got really hard, did you ever find yourself thinking, well, but at least, thank God, I'm not on a farm. I've been able to live a life of the mind and a life involved with politics.
Well, let me make 2 points. First, I don't really think I've ever been under that much tension. There were 2 periods in my life when I felt really deeply, terribly pressed and involved. One of them was in the autumn of 1962 in India, and the other I've already mentioned was when I was running the running price control. But other than that, I've lived a generally somewhat relaxed life. I don't want to give the impression that I've been harried. But let me tell you, my dear, I have never awakened once in my life without a murmur of thanks that I didn't have a day's work ahead of me on that Ontario farm. The escape from manual labor is something which no one should underestimate. It is the major objective of a very large number of people, and I was one.
You have a birthday coming up on October 15th. Can I get on the act early and wish you a happy birthday?
Oh, how very nice of you.
Well, John Kenneth Galbraith, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Well, it's a great pleasure being here. I'm a great defender of National Public Radio, as you know.
That's great, and we all appreciate it. Thank you for being with us. My guest has been John Kenneth Galbraith. His new book is titled Economics in Perspective, and it's just been published by Houghton Mifflin. He's an economist, a best-selling author, and a Harvard professor. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Albert Maysles. In the 1960s, he and his brother David pioneered the cinema verite style of documentary filmmaking. Their films include Gimme Shelter, about the Rolling Stones at Altamont, Grey Gardens, which follows the day-to-day life of Jacqueline Kennedy's eccentric aunt, Edith Bouvier-Beale, an Emmy Award-winning film on Vladimir Horowitz, and an early documentary on the Beatles' 1964 visit to the United States. So I hope you can join us.
The best things in life are free, but you can keep them for the best and these. Now give me more.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, actress Betty White talks about her career in television, from the early days of the medium when she got her start, to her Emmy Award-winning performance on The Mary Tyler Moore Show, to her current role on The Golden Girls. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Shades, the first album in 6 years from pianist Andrew Hill. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Star Trek, The Next Generation. This new version of the old TV series features a new cast, a new starship, and new adventures. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Three more senators say they'll vote no on the nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. Arizona Democrat Dennis DeConcini made his announcement this morning.
I have concluded that Judge Bork is not best for Arizona, this country, or for the Supreme Court.
Later, Connecticut Senator Lowell Weicker became the third Republican to speak out against the nomination, and Senate Democratic leader Robert Byrd followed suit. On the 14-member judiciary panel, 8 senators have now announced their opposition to Bork, 5 are in favor, and 1 is publicly undecided. Meanwhile, President Reagan continues to stand firm behind his nominee. Reporters ask him today whether he thinks the nomination will fail in committee. His reply, "Over my dead body." With the seat once occupied by Lewis Powell vacant, the Supreme Court opened the 1987-88 term today. The court rejected a claim by former White House aide Michael Deaver that part of the independent counsel law is unconstitutional. Deaver is being prosecuted under the law for perjury. He's accused of lying to a grand jury and to Congress about his lobbying activities shortly after he left the White House in 1985. The justices also gave condemned killer Ted Bundy another chance to save himself through the courts. More from UPI's Howard Dykus.
This is the same man TV made a movie about. Accused of killing many college co-eds, convicted of murdering 3 women, Ted Bundy says his lawyer was incompetent and should have questioned Bundy's mental health. Bundy's lawyer at the time was Bundy. He represented himself. Now he says he should have made the court consider his sanity, his competence to stand trial. The Supreme Court has accepted Bundy's argument. The state of Florida appealed a lower court order that a hearing be held on Bundy's competence, and Florida's appeal has been rejected. This puts off Bundy's execution and raises the possibility that if he convinces the courts he was insane, he may never sit in the electric chair. Howard Dykus, Washington.
New shooting broke out in the Persian Gulf today. Iraqi warplanes attacked an Iranian oil terminal in the Strait of Hormuz and fired on 4 supertankers, setting one of them on fire. Details from the BBC's Doug Llewellyn.
The shining star was left blazing fiercely, and more than 15 tugs were still trying to put out the blaze late this evening. Both she, the World Admiral under Liberian flag, and the Legacy, Cypriot registered, were lying off the Hormuz terminal, where they act as storage vessels for the crude oil and products that the shuttle tankers bring down the normally more hazardous waters on the Iranian side of the Gulf. The other supertanker, hit off nearby Larak Island, is the biggest vessel afloat, the 565,000-ton Seawise Giant, under Liberian colors, also a storage vessel. It was seen to have 20 or so holes in its side, which would indicate that the Iraqi Mirage must have flown low to strafe the targets.
The BBC's Doug Llewellyn reporting from the Gulf, where the search continued today for the missing pilot of a U.S. helicopter that crashed there last night. 3 other crew members were rescued. The Pentagon says the crash occurred during a routine night operation and did not involve any hostile activity. In Jacksonville, Florida, jury selection began today in the trial of Carlos Leder Rivas. The Colombian national is accused of leading the drug smuggling ring that brought more than 3 tons of cocaine into Florida and Georgia in 1979 and 1980. Leder also faces charges in Miami, where he's accused of leading a Colombian cartel said to be responsible for 80% of the cocaine smuggled into the United States. If convicted on all charges, Leder could face a prison term of life plus 165 years. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed off just a fraction in active trading to end the day at 2640.18. I'm Sharon Green, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Shades, a new album from pianist and composer Andrew Hill. Hill recorded several well-received albums for Blue Note back in the 1960s, when that label was setting the standard for mainstream modernism. Since then, Hill's music has drifted further from musical conventions, but Kevin says Hill has actually drawn from the language of his predecessors.
One of the commonplaces of jazz criticism is that the late Thelonious Monk has had little influence on other pianists. And yes, it's true that he spawned few outright imitators. But a number of piano players have tuned into Monk's ideas about using silence, space, and whimsy as elements of style. The best of them have taken those ideas and applied them to their own sounds. Take Andrew Hill, for example. He was born in Haiti and raised in Chicago, and has recorded for a number of labels since the early 60s. But his new album on Soul Note, Shades, is his first in 6 years. The reason Hill hasn't recorded much lately is that his style has gotten more eccentric as time's gone on. He'd always been a little left of center, but by the end of the 70s, his solo music had become so elliptical, it was almost as if he had a 3-second attention span. Shades finds Hill in trio and quartet settings. In those familiar formats, it's a lot easier to hear where or who he's coming from. His tune Monk's Glimpse makes sly reference to Monk's version of the old kindergarten hit This Old Man. And like his inspiration, Hill can be most radical when it's someone else's turn to solo. Unlike most accompanists, Hill doesn't mark off the chord changes as much as he provides a running commentary designed to encourage but not restrict the player who has the floor. In this case, the veteran tenor saxophonist Clifford Jordan. Andrew Hill and Clifford Jordan on Monk's Glimpse. There's more to Andrew Hill than a Monk strain. He can also play chords as lush as Liberace's and has an approach to small group organization beyond even Monk's. When Hill plays one of his tunes, it may be hard to tell where the written part ends and the improvising begins. He seems to start paraphrasing a melody from the opening bars. And his compositions are full of playful misdirection, little false endings and unexpected shifts in rhythm. On Ball Square, the trio of Hill, bassist Rufus Reed, and drummer Ben Riley pass the melody around from instrument to instrument. Even the drums have their say. And while no one raps out a steady beat, no one gets lost either. Each player is rhythmically self-reliant. I suggested earlier that Monk's influence on other piano players is more apparent now than it used to be. One reason it's easier to hear where his radical ideas have gone is that, as time passes, it's become easier to hear where they came from. 40 years ago, Monk seemed to exist in a vacuum. Nowadays, it's more evident that his style is an outgrowth of the Stride piano school of the 1920s. Although Andrew Hill has absorbed a heavy dose of Monk, you don't hear those Stride echoes in his playing. But that's not a problem. What you don't use is as crucial to forming a style as what you do use. If he sounded just like Monk, we wouldn't be talking about him. The point is that Andrew Hill's music is firmly rooted in the jazz tradition, no matter how off the wall it may sound on first hearing.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat, Cadence, and Jazz Times magazines. He reviewed Andrew Hill's new album, Shades. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Betty White. She's been working in her favorite medium, television, almost from its beginnings. Her first TV job was as an on-air Girl Friday for a talk show host in 1949. She won her first Emmy in 1952 for the sitcom Life with Elizabeth. More sitcoms and Emmys followed. She played Sue Ann Nivens, the happy homemaker, on The Mary Tyler Moore Show. She's now better known than ever in her current role as Rose on The Golden Girls. Betty White has just written a book called Betty White in Person, in which she reflects on her life and her long and varied career.
The beauty of it is I've been able to scatter shoot all through the years, talk shows, parades, commercials, game shows, situation comedies. I've had 7 series. It's hard to say where what started.
I think the first series that you had was called Life with Elizabeth.
Uh-huh.
Would you describe the character that you played?
They were young marrieds with no children, and she was not too bright, and he was maybe one shade brighter than she was. Neither one of them were nuclear physicists.
TV Guide in 1953 or 54 wondered if you'd become the TV version of America's sweetheart because of your role in that series. Did you ever feel stuck with that kind of image?
Nope, because I was doing a lot of other things along with it, and everybody thought of me as very sweet and yucky and all that stuff. But then at the same, when Jack Parr started, I did about 75 of his shows. And when you're in a talk show, you're yourself, so people could realize that you're not that ditzy character that they saw on the screen.
It was, I think, with the Mary Tyler Moore Show that you really started to get a different kind of image on TV. You played Sue Ann Nivens, the happy homemaker, who was the happy homemaker on television, but off screen she was very catty, conniving. How did you get cast in that image? It really seemed to be casting against type at the time.
Well, it was great fun. Mary and I were great and good friends, and the fourth year that her show was on, I had sweated out, my husband Alan Ludden and I had sweated out her pilot and the whole show, so we had a rooting interest in the show. So the writers came up with an idea. They wanted a yucky, icky, sweet Betty White type for a happy homemaker for a one-shot on the show. So I guess they tried a lot of other people and couldn't find anybody yucky enough, and so they called me and asked me if I'd like to do the show. And it was a thrill because, as I say, it was a one-shot, but that night they said that they were going home and starting another script, and 2 weeks later I was back with another script, and that was exciting.
Were you insulted at all that they were looking for this bland, sweet Betty White type?
Insulted? Of course not. They wouldn't say those things if they didn't know better about the lady herself. See, that's the fun of it. That's the humor of it. And you can be that type to some people in the audience who are looking for that, and some of the other people in the audience will see through that and see the rotten person underneath.
One of the things I really liked about the role was that it proved that you really had a sense of humor about the image that you had.
Well, I don't think anybody who knew me could have missed the fact that I had a sense of humor about that, because I never was being the sweet type. I had I've always had a rather bawdy sense of humor, and my mother and dad before me, there wasn't a straight man in the family. And so a lot of people, you'd meet them at a party, and they'd say, oh, gee, I didn't realize. I never liked you till I realized that you weren't that person.
Now you're in a series in which you've become better known and more popular, I think, than you've ever been in your career. Did you expect that as you got older, you'd get more visible, more popular?
Who would ever dream of such a thing? The four of us, Estelle and Bea and Rue and I, continually congratulate ourselves on the fact that this took off from nowhere. We had no idea we'd be getting into something like this. And it's a joy to work together, and we respect each other so professionally, but we didn't expect to also adore each other the way we do. We can't wait to go to work in the morning.
In a way, I think the characters on The Golden Girls have become role models of sorts for older women. Have you found that women have been inspired to live in small groups because they've seen it on television?
I don't know about living in small groups. All that I think we have accomplished is to show that there is an alternative lifestyle for the lonely ladies out there. If you notice, the Golden Girls are not together for economic reasons. They're together for sociological reasons. It combats the loneliness. And there are a lot of ladies out there who are not hurting for money, but they are hurting for friends and for associates. And I think it's given them a little hope that there is probably another way to go.
You've lived alone since the death of your husband, Alan Ludden. I guess that kind of lifestyle wouldn't be for you.
No, nor for Bea, nor for Rue, nor for Estelle, oddly enough, because Estelle maybe. Estelle might be able to do that. But we're all basically people who enjoy being alone, but that's only because we've worked in this business all our lives where we're with people all the time. So being alone is a boon. And I'm sure that drives everybody crazy who is lonely and wishes they had more to do. And I appreciate that. I appreciate the fact that I am in that position more than I can tell you.
I think one of the things that people get concerned with when they live alone, especially as they get older, is, say I get sick and there's no one there. No one there to take care of me, or no one there to call the doctor. Does this kind of thing worry you ever?
Yeah, I must admit, it doesn't worry you, but you think about it. You're concerned about it. And fortunately, you have people who do check on you every once in a while. If they know if they don't talk to you quite often, they better see what's cooking. But it's a concern. You think that's when maybe you feel a little more alone than you ever have.
Your new book covers a lot of different subjects. Some of the subjects are very personal. Others are just your views on different topics. One of the things you wrote about is your mother and how her life changed when she became a widow, and how she suddenly started working more, and slowly a woman who spent most of her time alone had this huge network of friends. You said that most of her friends were widows, like she was. And the way you describe her, it sounds like in many ways she really thought of herself as a widow after your father died. And I was wondering, when your husband died, how much that sense of being a widow defined your life or your identity?
Well, it's very, you still feel like a fifth wheel if you're, you know, if you're the single-o, if you're going out to dinner with a couple of friends. But I must admit that's less and less. And remember, personally, my situation is I'm so lucky, but I was alone a long time before I married Alan. I had an early marriage, a brief one, and then I was happily single for a long time until he finally wore me down and sold me on the institution of marriage. So I really didn't mind being alone. I think in the instance of a lot of widows these days, no matter what business or non-business they're in, I think the situation has changed so much that they no longer feel like outcasts. There are so many other things that they can do now. They can take the initiative now and get into various things, meet other people. And if they feel like pairing off, there are even ways of meeting people in that situation. But I think we've come a long way, baby. I really think so.
Now that you're in The Golden Girls, do fans relate to you differently than they did, say, when you were in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, or even before that, when you were in your early sitcoms?
Not really. It's the same one-on-one. Remember, I've always been just a television child. Not films, not stage. There's not that guard all wall out there that keeps you kind of remote from your people. You've been in their home. They haven't gone to someplace in a big audience to see you. So you feel like you're a friend of somebody under those circumstances. The only change is that with the popularity of Mary and then the popularity of the Golden Girls, the numbers of the people who stop you increase. But the relationship is really the same.
Why haven't you done films? Was that intentional?
That was by choice. I've done a couple cameo appearances, but that doesn't appeal to me. Television, you're working all the time. I mean, you get into it, you're busy. With films, many times you have to go on location, you're away from home, you're not in every scene, so you do a scene and then you sit and wait forever. And when you've been used to television, that's a grueling experience, and I don't feel any ego need to be on the big screen because I reach a lot of people on the little screen. I've turned down several Broadway shows because, again, I love my home and I want to live in it.
Actress and author Betty White. Her new book, Betty White in Person, is published by Doubleday. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, it's the eve of the committee vote on the Bork nomination. Any update?
Yes. So today we had two senators coming out against, Weicker of Connecticut, a Republican, and DeConcini of Arizona, a Democrat. We profile, Cookie Roberts does, an undecided senator, Howell Heflin, Democrat of Alabama. That also a talk with Howard Bloom, the author of I Pledge Allegiance, a new book about the excellent book about the Walker family spy scandal, and oysters.
What about oysters?
A portrait of an oysterman in South Carolina. The oyster industry is in trouble. They are actually importing them from Korea now.
Okay, well, thank you, Robert. Sure. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been nearly 20 years since the last episode of the original Star Trek series was produced. Subsequent movies, reruns, and conventions may have eased the loss for some fans. Now Trekkie diehards have a reason to rejoice. A new series, Star Trek The Next Generation, is one of this fall's syndicated weekly TV shows. Our television critic David Bianculli has a review.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
That's right, Star Trek is back. What you just heard is the opening of the show, and it's different from the old Star Trek opening in three important respects. Number one, it tells us the Enterprise is on a continuing mission, not a five-year one. Number two, it changes the phrase where no man has gone before to where no one has gone before. Number three, the words are spoken by a different voice. These may sound like inconsequential, nitpicky changes, and maybe they are in the global view of things. But Star Trek loyalists are going to be analyzing every episode of Star Trek The Next Generation with a fine-toothed phaser. The good news, the unexpectedly good news, is that this new Star Trek series holds up. More than holds up. It's a blast. The changes between Star Trek, which ran from 1966 to 1969, and The Next Generation are everywhere. It's set 78 years after the old Star Trek adventures. The Enterprise is brand new, and so is the cast. Because the new Enterprise can fly longer than 5 years without returning to base, it's now a floating city in space, which means there are children and spouses aboard. The change to where no one has gone before is only one indication of the show's non-sexist attitude. Women have positions of power on this new Enterprise, and there's even a Klingon on the bridge. And the most powerful position of all, the starship captain, is played by a distinguished older actor named Patrick Stewart. He's not only an infinitely better actor than William Shatner, but his character acts more logically as well. This captain doesn't risk his life by beaming down whenever there's an emergency on some hostile planet. He sends his first officer, played by Jonathan Frakes, who has what is essentially the Kirk role from the first series. He's also a much better actor than Shatner. The rest of the cast is terrific, too. Terrific at least by sci-fi TV standards. The two-hour telemovie pilot, Encounter at Farpoint, introduces them all nicely, and also introduces John DeLancey as Q, one of the all-time best Star Trek villains. Gene Roddenberry, who also created the original Star Trek show, hasn't forgotten what made it such a cult hit. His new series, like the old, blends moral messages with warm human, and sometimes inhuman, relationships. The most notable change is a good one. The special effects in The Next Generation are as convincing as the ones on the old show were tacky. Despite its current cult following, the original Star Trek lasted only 3 years on NBC and never drew more than 29% of the viewing audience. This new Star Trek is shown in syndication, not on any particular network, so it may have a hard time building and keeping an audience, too. But if later episodes match the quality of the two-hour pilot, The Next Generation deserves to be a hit. Star Trek isn't just back. It's better.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Mo Tucker. She was the drummer of the group The Velvet Underground. When they broke up in the early 70s, she gave up music. Now she's back in the recording studio with a new band. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will survey the early recordings of Smokey Robinson. With the Miracles as his backup singers, Robinson defined the early Motown sound. And book critic John Leonard will review The Fords, the new biography of the family that built the automotive empire. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Research assistants from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.